Hello. Welcome to Blogging Heads. I'm David Frum. I'm here to talk with a new blogging head, Amjad Atallah, who is director of the Middle East Policy Project at the New America Foundation. And it's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Maybe I will kick out a first question to you. Our topic is Gaza. We are, I think, today on the 19th day of the war. It looks like there are two major consequences that we can see so far. One is a serious degradation of Hamas's combat capability, and the other is serious damage to the infrastructure and civilian population of Gaza. I guess the question I'd like to pose to you is that this war will end. It will probably end in reasonably short order. At that point, what opportunities and challenges do these two changes present for American policy? Is there hope that we can use what has been done in Gaza to build a more stable situation in Israel and the Palestinian territories?
Well, we're unfortunate that we're going to have to treat it like an opportunity, even though it's it's yet another disaster in the history of the Arab-Israeli dispute. We're going to obviously have to try to build on it. I think one of the things we're going to have to do is provide an alternative form of deterrence to both the Israelis and the Palestinians. Unfortunately, both have gotten into a pattern of believing that threatening or assaulting the civilian populations on either side of the border are the best way to create political pressure for change in the political positions of either government. And as long as they both believe that they can use civilians in that way, we're going to continue to see civilian casualties, whether it's the 3 on the Israeli side or the 900 on the Palestinian side.
Wait. 900 is the total Palestinian casualty list, right?
That's right. About half are believed, half to a third are believed to be civilians.
And a considerable number of those are believed to have been killed by Hamas itself.
No.
Well, there are reports, for example, of people arriving in Palestinian hospitals with wounds to the kneecap, for example. That doesn't sound like anything the Israelis have.
Right. I'm not sure that those people actually are considered part of the casualty count. I know that there are reports that Hamas has been trying to round up people it accuses of being collaborators. But even if you assume that, even if you blame Hamas morally for the deaths of the civilians, the Palestinian civilians, it still begs the question of how can the United States, what can the United States do policy-wise right. that creates a different form of deterrence where neither Israeli civilians nor Palestinian civilians can be in the crossfire.
Yes.
And I think one of the things that we've seen in the last 6 months is something we have to learn from. Over the last 6 months, we saw that Israel had this tight siege on Gaza. And so in order to keep to break the siege, in order to keep starvation from setting in, Hamas built this wide network of tunnels, very Vietnam Cong-like, a network of tunnels between Egypt and between Gaza. Now, it's virtually impossible for that to have been built without Egypt's involvement in some way, either by turning a blind eye to it or by assisting. There's oil traveling through those tunnels. There was goats, food, medical equipment, and, of course, weapons. And if all of this had been above ground, we would have been in a much better position to be able to monitor what should be going in and what shouldn't be going in. The problem is that for 6 months, this was completely avoided. And I'm still to this day unclear as to why the United States chose to simply walk away from that for the last 6 months. This was inevitable in result of what was happening.
You say a number of things I find very remarkable and probably won't be able to unpack them all, but let me start with just one of them. When you talked about, you seem to integrate Hamas and Fatah into one thing called a Palestinian government, and then, many ways it has is not a government, you describe it as if it were, or maybe I misunderstood you. But we have two different Palestinian territories, one with a legal government and one with a de facto government. That's Hamas and Gaza. Although the Hamas government doesn't really act like a government, doesn't accept any of the responsibilities of a government.
Actually, I think that's backward. You're right. I wasn't meaning to conflate Fatah and Hamas. You have a Palestinian administering authority in Gaza, and you have a Palestinian administering authority in the West Bank. The Hamas claims legitimacy because it won democratic elections and became the government.
Well, wait. It won parliamentary elections.
parliamentary elections, and the system that the Palestinians have is a parliamentary one.
And then they had a violent coup when President Abbas then tried to use his presidential powers. Hamas made a violent coup in Gaza.
Right. So what you have are two administering authorities. That's why I'm saying I'm not claiming legitimacy for either the Fatah, or the international community has obviously sided with one arm of the Palestinian factions. But you have two, Fatah and Hamas. Ultimately, they're going to have to work out their disagreements. They're going to have to form some form of unity government that will allow Abbas to play a primacy in negotiations. It's only to their benefit. I mean, this would only be to the Palestinian benefit in terms of negotiating a better deal. If the Palestinians remain fractured, they obviously reduce their negotiating leverage.
But if the Palestinians continue to include a terrorist organization in their leadership, they remain an illegitimate factor in world politics.
Well, as far as the Israelis have been concerned, the Palestinians have always been a terrorist organization, just
right.
as a people.
But you
or
wouldn't
as
dispute,
as a group.
But you yourself would agree that Hamas is a terrorist organization.
Hamas has used terrorism.
So you think it's not a terrorist organization?
I don't know what that means, so I don't
want
to define
it. So you don't understand,
don't
you find the concept too complicated?
Yeah, the idea that Hamas has utilized terrorism is without a doubt. Does that mean that a civilian in the Ministry of Education that has been appointed by a Hamas-led government that won elections, does that mean that that person or the teacher that gets paid by a Hamas official, does that mean that the teacher is a terrorist? That, I believe, is...
No, that means he's employed by a terrorist organization, if Hamas is paying aside. That doesn't strike me as a... the U.S. government makes these distinctions. They determine that certain organizations are terrorists. That's grafted into law. There's a legal definition.
Right. And for U.S. legal purposes, Hamas is a terrorist organization.
But not for U.S. purposes. You don't find it a useful analytic concept to think of terrorist organizations.
Right. I believe it oversimplifies it. It keeps us from actually
now, would you
unpacking
apply that to all terror? You said there's no such thing as a terrorist organization, that all terrorist organizations, you've just
no,
found the country, or that there is such a thing as a terrorist organization, but Hamas isn't one.
I believe that there are groups that
why
are
do you
probably
laugh? It's
terrorist
a serious,
organizations.
I mean, your analysis.
Well, you're attempting to put me in a position where I would appear to be defending Hamas.
No, I just want you say that some things are too... I mean, we need analytic clarity here if we're going to move forward, and
right.
some things... And you say this concept is too complicated, and so I just want to understand why you find it so complicated.
Well, because you have groups like Al-Qaeda, for example. They have no electoral base. They have no constituency. They're simply a terrorist organization. They're an organization that's dedicated to using terrorism to accomplish certain political ends. Now, that organization is a terrorist organization. Now, in the United States, legally, both Hamas and Al-Qaeda are both terrorist organizations.
So let me stop you before, never mind legally, just for you, in your analysis. So Al-Qaeda is a terrorist organization because it doesn't have a constituency, and Hamas is an organization that does terrorist things, and the difference is not terrorism, the difference is that Hamas has a constituency, and that is what prevents it from being a terrorist organization.
Well, does an elected government, if there was an elected government that utilizes terrorism, does that make the entire government a terrorist organization? If Iran is engaged in supporting terrorism, does that make the entire Iranian government a terrorist organization?
No, and for this reason, that the usual definition of a terrorist of terrorism is violence by a non-state actor against civilian populations for political ends. So
actually, Warren Rudman and George Mitchell came up with a different definition of terrorism when they were doing the Warren Mitchell...
Remind me?
The Sharm el-Sheikh report. And they basically said that the terrorism was, as a working definition for them, terrorism was the threat or use of violence against civilians or other non-combatants in order to achieve a political aim. They didn't use it by non-state actors or by state actors.
See, I think that's an important distinction. I mean, governments commit atrocities. What Russia did in Grozny, for example, mm-hmm. that's an mm-hmm. atrocity. In my book, that would not be terrorism, precisely because it's carried out by a state. And as you can have a state that sponsors terrorism as a method when the state doesn't want to leave its fingerprints on it, and that's what Iran does. But I think it would be fair. I wouldn't describe Iran, the government of Iran, as a terrorist organization, although precisely because it is a state. If you're a non-state actor, that's where you become a terrorist organization. That's where we need the term an organization. Now we can talk about a state being, as Iran is, a rogue state, a violent state, a state committed to atrocities, and that creates its own set of problems. But that's a different thing from these organizations like Hamas and Al-Qaeda.
Well, I think it's important to make sure that we distinguish between marketing tools in terms of spinning a particular foreign policy idea, and
are you suggesting? I'm sorry. Did you suggest I was marketing and spinning?
Analyzing. Well, I think that, for example, if it's not relevant to the debate we're having on Gaza right now, whether you consider Hamas a terrorist organization or a government that employs terrorism.
No, it's hugely relevant. I mean, one of the because. Where we began this line of discussion was you said it would be useful to integrate Hamas into the Palestinian governing structure. And I raised an eyebrow at that and said, would it really be? How would it be useful? And, I mean, if it's a terrorist organization, it's not a good thing to integrate it into a governing structure. And that's where we began. So this is essential to our analysis of how the U.S. policy is going to move forward, because I know there's a big push on right now in the American foreign policy community among certain advocates to say that all of this points to the need to work with and include Hamas. There are others who say, no, this points to that they are an incurably violent and dangerous organization and that there can be no effective work in this dispute so long as Hamas remains as potent a factor as it does.
Well, look at the PLO. The PLO is a terrorist organization as far as the United States was concerned,
right.
Correct?
And they were.
And as far as Israel was concerned.
Right.
However, the United States maintained relations with the PLO through the CIA in order to maintain American interests in Lebanon.
They maintained clandestine and undeclared. I mean, you always need to know what's going on, and you need to have information and intelligence.
But we had more than that. We had a relationship with the PLO where the PLO was asked to protect American interests in Lebanon when the PLO had a state within a state in Lebanon. And the PLO did that in exchange for I don't know what. But the PLO did that.
But it's the in exchange for but we did not the United States did not act to legitimate the PLO as a political actor until the PLO had passed a series of milestones, however sincerely or insincerely.
Without that relationship that the United States had with the PLO, we may never have gotten to the point where we could have had relations with the PLO. Would have been a point where the PLO would have actually recognized Israel's right to exist.
That's a prudential decision. Sometimes groups respond to carrots, sometimes groups respond to sticks. It's not an ideological a priori question that the carrot is always better.
So do you believe that it's possible in the Palestinian context to wipe out Hamas?
Do I believe it's possible to wipe out Hamas?
Yes.
Probably not. What I think we can do is create incentives for the Palestinians where they realize it is that Hamas is not going to serve them well. And that they need to make, and this has always been the Palestinian problem going back to the 1940s, they need to make a strategic decision to disavow terrorism if they want to get anywhere.
Well, Fatah has disavowed terrorism,
right.
And it hasn't gotten anywhere.
No,
that's not necessarily a positive carrot.
Fatah got offered a state in 2000 and 2001. It got a big
they
offer.
Weren't.
It turned it down, but it got a big offer.
No, that's an accurate assessment of what happened at the time. The Palestinians, when they were at Camp David, said, let's continue the negotiations, and the negotiations continued. What they disagreed with was the original opening bargaining position or negotiating position that Ehud Barak presented them.
Yeah, people in negotiations get offers all the time that they don't like exactly. That's it. And they negotiate, exactly, but Arafat instead went to war, so they didn't.
Arafat did not go to war.
It looked like a war to me.
Well, it was a war on the... The intifada that started up as a result of that, or as a consequence after Camp David, grew was not controlled, in my opinion, by Yasser Arafat.
And what do you base that on?
The consensus
view differed. The general view disagrees with you. So why are we wrong?
Well, I was there at the time. I'm not sure if the general. I guess it would be the general view of which class. There were a lot of people in Europe and elsewhere who knew Arafat, who spoke with Arafat. I think even the American negotiators who spoke with Arafat realized that he didn't have the personal capacity or even the mental capacity at that time. He was already beginning to have episodes of senility. And I think that everyone realized that he wasn't necessarily fully in charge of everything that was happening on the ground. We had a moment, I think, where a lot of American diplomats came to the region and had that very same question that you have. Well, is Arafat in charge of this, and how can we end it? And they met with him, and after they met with him, I think the conclusion was...
Somebody else is doing it.
Well, they're not sure who is in charge.
Yeah. Okay, but that's why we talked about Fatah and not about Arafat. That Fatah was offered this and made a decision for war. It lost the war.
You're trying to present a story in which the Israelis are justified in maintaining the occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip.
Well, the occupation of both is over. Occupation of Gaza has been over since 2005. The occupation of the West Bank, more or less at the same time, it's over.
David, well, how under what circumstances do you consider the West Bank of the occupation of the West Bank over?
The Israelis don't exercise political jurisdiction there. They don't have a troop presence there.
Do exercise political jurisdiction. The Palestinian Parliament cannot pass a law that the contradicts or disagrees with any Israeli military regulation or law. The Israelis have the authority to shut down the Palestinian Parliament anytime they want. Any Palestinian ministry cannot exist except through and in cooperation with the Israeli government. They're still operating under the Oslo principles.
They're still operating under the Oslo principles, but they have autonomy, and they have separation, and they have every ability to exercise jurisdiction within their territory. And that's even That's even more true in Gaza.
Israeli troops can enter Ramallah at any time without requesting any assistance, without requesting permission from the Palestinians. They can enter into Hebron, into Jenin, into Nablus. They have complete scope of activity. The West Bank is integrated into Israel. If you go to Israel and ask for a map at the Hertz counter, they'll give you a map of Israel that includes the West Bank.
Well, if you go to the Hertz counter in Damascus, they'll give you a map of the Middle East that doesn't have Israel on it at all. So,
well, I'm not defending Damascus.
No, but the point is that they can print what they want on their maps. My point in all this is to say, look, we need to I'm very interested in the question I posed to you at the beginning, which is, the United States has some interest here. We want, obviously, quiet in this conflict. We want stability, and we want to discourage terrorism, and we want to build some kind of stable entity in the West Bank and Gaza that can exercise authority. So, are you one of those who takes the view that the United States can do that while giving any kind of scope to Hamas?
I think that just as we followed a policy in Iraq where we decided that we were going to have to talk to the Sunni insurgents who were attacking American troops. We were going to have to talk to them because we needed to find out who among them we could buy off, who among them we could convince to buy into the idea of a free Iraq, right? So we had to talk to them. We had to figure out who among them were implacably opposed to us and who among them were not. And that process actually worked surprisingly well. In Afghanistan,
General Petraeus is saying
we're going to have to talk to the Taliban, right?
Yeah.
And so we're going to have to talk to the Taliban, not because General Petraeus wants to appease the Taliban, but because we need to find out who among the Taliban might be brought into the idea of a free Afghanistan, who might be brought into the idea of a political system in a free Afghanistan.
Well, that makes
it's
total
odd
sense.
That we're going to draw the line at Hamas and say, okay, well, that's the one group we're not going to talk to at all, in order to find out who among them might be bought into a political process.
Sorry, that's a mischaracterization of what happened in all those places. In Afghanistan, what we are doing is we do not sit down with the Taliban council or whatever their leadership is. We use intelligence, not diplomacy, as a way to identify detachable elements of the Taliban, people who basically are tribal, people who have, appeasable grievances. And then once we know who those people are, then we make efforts toward them. Same thing in Iraq, that we try to figure out who here.
And that's what I'm arguing
so
for
you're,
in the
but
case.
That makes total, if for. That's what you're arguing for, that makes total sense, that you use intelligence measures to try to identify cooperative elements. But that concedes nothing to the formal leadership of a terrorist organization. What you're trying in that case to do is to sever the organization and break it and take people away from it so as to isolate it and destroy it politically, to integrate it into government. That's a very different thing.
The goal is to ensure Israel security and to ensure a free Palestinian state that is bought into a regional American security architecture.
Yes,
that's the goal.
I agree with that.
The goal of destroying Hamas is completely irrelevant to this. It might be necessary at some point to do that. It might not be. It might be necessary, in fact, not to do that in order to achieve those objectives. That's not the first thing is that we have to agree on the objectives. If the objectives are to maintain Israeli security and to have a free and democratic Palestinian state in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, that's part of a unified regional security architecture that's friendly to our interests, then that's the goal that we have to try to pursue. Hamas, we need to find out who in and within Hamas might buy into that kind of idea, who has grievances that we can buy into.
Okay, how do we find that out?
If we agree that the West Bank and the Gaza Strip have to be free, then that's part of what a large percentage of Hamas actually want. There's a percentage of Hamas that wants a lot more than that, and that's the percentage we have to identify and move away.
Okay, so I think I would agree with 95% of what you just said. I would have a question mark of whether a free and independent Palestinian state is consistent with Israeli security. But if it is, absolutely yes.
That's the rub, David. That's the big rub, because in fact a lot of people I think agree with you that it's not consistent.
I didn't make an assertion that it's not consistent. It's a question. I believed in the Oslo process at the time, which I feel now rather sheepish about. But if it is, then great.
Many people do.
but if not, then trouble. Now I don't have a view on that. I don't know. I don't have a conclusion. But I don't think it's a fact that the two are automatically consistent. I think we've got a problem.
Well, I think we need to interpret them in a way that they are consistent, because I think that from an American perspective, we've got to have as our interest both the security of both a free and secure Israel and a free and secure Palestine.
So what's your methodology for identifying for answering this question about Hamas? How do we find out whether it's true that they are detachable elements?
Well, first of all, there are a lot of countries that are, in fact, able to talk to Hamas and could find out or could pursue these courses of investigation. Turkey, for example.
But you keep saying, when you say talk to Hamas, what does that mean? That means talking to Hamas leadership. These are the people whom we're trying to isolate.
Talk to the decision makers on one level, and then we have to have a conversation with the Palestinian public on a different level.
Just to
be on the record, I'm opposed to putting pressure on civilian populations in order to achieve political objectives. So I'm opposed to starving Palestinians in the hopes that they'll overthrow a government that we don't like or that is engaged in terrorism. I'm not opposed to sanctions on individuals who are engaged in criminal activity. I'm not opposed to attempting to arrest people who are engaged in criminal activity. But attempting to starve people in order to have them overthrow people, that hasn't worked before. I mean, and even if it does work, I think it's morally questionable.
So what does that mean in practice? That you open up the crossings in Egypt and you...
Right, and you demilitarize the Gaza Strip. You open it up to economic aid. You open it up to food. You open it up to medicine. You open it up to development. You don't open it up to weapons.
And who's going to be doing the policing of this and the arresting?
Well, that's where I think now we're going to have to start thinking outside the box. I think the argument that under the Oslo process was that we were going to have the Palestinians in charge of Palestine right from the beginning, and we were going to have the Israelis, of course, working closely with them, and there was going to be a very friendly peace between the two countries. And I think that if Rabin had succeeded, I think if he hadn't been assassinated, he may have succeeded in creating that type of a two-state deal. The situation now may be different, and I think we're going to have to look at potentially international troops and international involvement in order to...
What does that mean specifically?
It could mean a Martin Indyk approach. It could mean a Kosovo-style approach.
You mean NATO?
Yeah.
So can you seriously envision NATO troops hunting down Hamas terrorists, arresting them and killing them? They won't
within
do it in
the context.
In Afghanistan, we can't get them to do it.
Within the context of a free Palestinian state, yes. Within the context of a continued Israeli occupation, no.
But Afghanistan is a free state. It's internationally
right.
recognized. The troops are there, subject to all kinds of international mandates. And yet, most of the NATO countries that are there don't do that kind of hunting-killing work at all, remotely. Nothing to do with
well,
it.
Well, first of all, I mean, the hunting-killing stuff is... the word killing is... It's a strong, nice, macho term, but
okay, hunting, arresting.
Legally, let's say hunting and arresting and capturing or bringing to justice,
right.
if you would. I think that NATO countries are, in fact, far more willing to try to be involved in stabilizing an Israeli-Palestinian peace deal than they are in Afghanistan or in Iraq. Now, there are lots of different reasons for that. Some of them I understand, some of them I don't, but there are a lot of different reasons for that. But they're obviously more willing to. Consider after the war in Lebanon in 2006. It took only about a week to gather all the resources needed for the UN peacekeeping force to go to Lebanon from all of our European allies. Now compare it to Sudan and Darfur.
And how many?
We can't get a single helicopter.
How many Hezbollah terrorists have the Europeans arrested in Lebanon?
But that hasn't been their mandate.
And you think
you would potentially have a different mandate in a Palestinian state?
Would you?
It would have to be one that Israel. Remember, this is going to be a consensual process.
Yeah.
So Israel's going to agree to it. Israel's only going to agree to what it believes it's going to be in its best interest. The Palestinians are only going to agree to that thing which provides them with sovereignty and freedom.
And so we're going to have the French and the Italians and the Dutch and the Belgians and Americans? Canadians?
Yeah, I don't know about Americans.
Okay, no, probably not Americans. In Gaza and the West Bank, policing it. Arresting terrorists, which they've never done anywhere else.
Well, look at Kosovo. Look at Kosovo. They've been involved in police work in Kosovo. They've actually been involved in trying to stop the human trafficking that was going through Kosovo. They've been trying to stop the drug trade that was going through Kosovo. And they've tried to keep a lid on any attempts by extremist KLA members to try to attack Serb forces, while at the same time trying to keep the Serbs from attacking Albanians or Kosovars inside Kosovo.
Have there been arrests of KLA members?
NATO has a police force that's in charge of arresting people, and they run their own prisons.
The KLA, of course, has nothing like the kind of political constituency in Europe that the Palestinian organizations have, so that may be an easier lift. But even still, I'm not conscious of them picking up anybody other than low-level hoodlums.
I don't know who they've arrested or
but not political.
The name
they don't arrest political leaders. That would provoke retaliation against them.
No, that's not true. As a matter of fact, remember that the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia actually indicted the prime minister of the Kosovars. Because they accused him of having been involved in incidents of war crimes during the war. And he actually turned himself in because of the entire context of having a NATO European-led military force in the country. He felt the best way to handle it was to turn himself in to be investigated.
So this is you think, feasible, and this is where you would like to see, what you would like to see us working toward, is some kind of international police force policing the Palestinian areas.
I think we're going to have to think of out-of-the-box solutions. There's not going to be a way that, if we want to say that we'll wait until the Palestinians have a perfect democratic government under occupation. We'll wait until the Palestinians are completely trustworthy. Remember that the United States helped create the Palestinian police force before, under Arafat.
Right, that's true.
And then in 2002, Israel dismantled that and took down the police force, attacked the police stations, attacked the prisons, attack the ministries, and everything was for naught. Now we're creating the security.
Well, because the police force was a corrupt disaster, right, and violent,
the Israeli argument was that they weren't doing enough to capture the Hamas people who were committing the suicide bombings.
No, I think.
So by attacking the police stations, they were hoping to put pressure on the Palestinian police to hunt down Hamas.
They also believed that the police force itself had become a paramilitary weapon against them, as it was in the fighting in 1996, for example.
That wasn't the argument the Israelis were using in 2002. Your argument is a better one, though. If they should have made that argument in 2002, because the argument that attacking police in order to get them to hunt down people who are committing terrorist attacks was a non-starter.
Well, Israelis also have an interest in maintaining the fiction that the PA works better than it does.
Yes, because it actually handles the costs of the occupation for them. So it is something that's more that's in as much in Israel's interest as it is in Fatah's interest.
So where you see us going is there's some kind of international trusteeship over the Palestinian territories.
Except that we're going to have to fast forward the sovereignty bit. In Kosovo, remember, the NATO forces were there for some 10 years before they could actually, before Kosovo announced its independence, and then countries recognized its independence, although not all countries, and because of the veto of Russia at the Security Council, they haven't been able to get a UN seat. Now, I don't think that you want to be in a position of doing that in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, because one of our vital interests as Americans is to ensure that Israel has a peace agreement with all the Arab states. And so we're going to have to fast forward the Palestinian freedom part. In other words, having a Palestinian state, even if a Palestinian government nominally cedes responsibility for security to NATO forces at the beginning and at the outset. And even if that takes 10 years, that's fine. But in order to maintain both Palestinian security and Israeli security, because the Palestinians, of course, have a vested interest in making sure that nobody invades their territory either. Israel wants to make sure that nobody threatens Israel.
So this independent Palestinian state that you hypothesize, it wouldn't have the right to tell the NATO troops to leave?
It would cede authority to do that.
What does that, sorry, explain that to me.
Well, it's a sovereign state, so it would have to cede authority and say, well, for this period of time, we give you this right. And
so it wouldn't be conditions-based.
Well, it couldn't be conditions-based, but the Palestinians, there's a practical condition, because the Palestinians know that they could be reoccupied by Israel in a matter of a week or less if NATO forces were withdrawn.
So from the point of view of Hamas, their best option is to get the forces in, keep them sort of hostages. Hopefully they'll be ineffective.
I don't believe Hamas actually wants this idea. I'm recommending something I believe is in America's national interest. I don't think that either Fatah or Hamas have asked for this, and I don't believe that Hamas actually would support it.
Okay, so tell me in more detail the end state that you envision, and then our step by step path to get to this end state.
Well, actually, I don't know if I have all the answers for that right now. I think that the we're first of all wrapping our head around what the new terrain looks like because of this current latest round of fighting.
But
it's going to be very unlikely that Hamas is coming out of this politically weaker, although it's going to come out of this militarily and tactically and structurally weaker. So there's not going to be a political gain on our side vis-a-vis Hamas, but there may be a tactical gain vis-a-vis Israel's side. We have a problem because we have a tremendous number of Palestinian casualties in the Gaza Strip and about 10 years of development work that would need to go in to bring Gaza up to the level of poverty that it was at 20 days ago. And so we've got to figure out how we can actually be seen to be engaging in that and connect that to a long-term process that achieves our overarching aims. And I think that we don't know all the answers yet.
Do you think it's important?
We haven't actually done a lot of these. We haven't had these conversations yet.
Do you think it's important that reconstruction assistance move through new kinds of channels so as to bypass the Hamas infrastructure for delivering benefits to their friends and isolating their enemies within Gaza?
Well, the problem is both Fatah and Hamas use aid as a patronage tool.
So,
right?
My question is, do we bypass them? Do we build new kinds of institutions that maybe don't employ so many local people?
You want to employ local people. I mean, you want as many local people employed as possible. What you don't want to do is there's no point in having it done in the old-fashioned way where we send in foreign consultants who pick up 80% of every dollar of aid when that money could be spent on the ground. So we want that money spent on the ground. The question is, how is it distributed and who is it distributed through?
Okay, how do you see that working?
Well, it might not be too early to begin talking about some international model to move in and be able to. We've already begun doing this. Even the European Union has a police force that had begun deploying in police stations in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And we actually had European Union monitors that were supposed to be at the border crossing points. What we can do is take that as a starting point and build up on it.
Go on. We're looking at the reconstruction and aid part. How would that be a model for civilian reconstruction? And
it may be possible then to also have Europeans or maybe even the Turks. The Turks may be in the best position possible, actually, because they position themselves very well by maintaining their relationship with Israel and their fundamental security alliance with Israel, while at the same time being adamantly critical of the operation in Gaza. They actually have the support of a lot of Palestinians, where even countries like Egypt don't.
Do we close the UN Relief Works Administration?
No.
Why not? I mean, because that's become a huge Hamas
weapon. That's the only reason you don't have starvation in Gaza.
Well, but except it's become a sort of tool of Hamas policy. So if we're bypassing these...
No, it's been an old Israeli argument that UNRWA is... I had an Israeli once tell me that they would rather shut down UNRWA before Hamas. And I think that's a very unfortunate attitude. The truth of the matter is that we don't have any tool that could replace UNRWA. We don't have anything that's on the ground building schools in all the refugee camps, that has clinics in the refugee camps, that feeds half the population. Israel itself needs UNRWA right now, because without UNRWA, there'd be pictures of starving Palestinian children.
I thought what you were talking about was creating an EU-RA, where it would be the European Union, maybe with some American money too,
or Turkish,
but that would create new channels so as to bypass and isolate the Hamas welfare state, and to take away the things they need to hold on to their patronage power.
You can try. I'm saying that this needs to be done comprehensively as part of a plan to create a Palestinian state. It should not be done with the sole. This is our problem. We become fixated on defeating Hamas. We confuse our strategic goal with defeating Hamas and not with securing Israel's security interests. Those are not the same thing. And we confuse creating a Palestinian state with as you put it, well, only if it's in the interest of Israeli national security. Well, we can talk to Ehud Olmert, and Ehud Olmert will say that it's in Israel's interest to create a Palestinian state. We can talk to Bibi Netanyahu, and he'll tell us, no, it's not in Israel's national security interest to have a Palestinian state. Now, we have to decide as Americans, though, what our opinion on this is.
Right. I said a softer thing, I hope I did anyway, okay. Which is consistent with, that is to say, from Israel's point of view, a Palestinian state may not be the first choice. The question is, can they live with it? Can it be managed in a way that is consistent with maintaining the security of this ally of the United States? If so, that's a different that's different than saying, well, they're really going to like it. They may have to eat it anyway, whether they like it or not. But it's a question of is it? But it may just be inconsistent. That's the question.
Okay, so then, well, if it's inconsistent, there wouldn't be a Palestinian state because Israel wouldn't allow it to be created. If Israel decides, though, as a political matter, that it wants Judea and Samaria, as it calls the West Bank, to remain integrated into Israel, but its biggest problem is divesting itself of the Palestinian population in the cities, that's a problem. I think that contradicts America's national security interests in the region as a whole, and that's a conversation that we have to have with the Israelis. And so going back to Gaza, I think that one of the things that we are going to Hamas and Fatah have both tried very hard to maintain the Palestinian struggle, as it were, as a Palestinian issue. They have not been willing to subcontract it out, in a sense, to groups that are trying to take advantage. As you know, Osama bin Laden, I think, or Zawahiri yesterday issued another video calling on people to fight Israel. And the Palestinians, both Hamas and Fatah, have been very good at trying to put up an iron wall between Salafist groups that are
not Iran.
More nihilistic.
They work with Iran.
Well, even Hamas, for example, has tried to distance itself from Iran, except after it realized it was going to be placed under siege and Iran was the only country that was willing to assist it. After Hamas won the parliamentary elections,
according to Matthew Levitt, who knows more about these things than I do, I mean, they've been taking money from Iran for a decade.
Right, but after they won the elections, first of all, in order to run in the elections, they stopped the suicide bombing. And then after they ran in the elections, the first thing they did was they flew to Turkey and then to Iran. And in Turkey, they gave a speech in which they said the Turkish model for Islamic governance was the model that they wanted to experiment with, the model that they wanted to look at for Palestine. And then they went to Iran, and then they thanked Iran for its moral support. Now, those are two
things. Only semi-grateful. I guess the material support was something they didn't want to deliver a thank you for.
Well, I think that the material support is something that they would rather probably not have. They would probably rather get that from Arabs than they would from Iran. But they accept it from Iran because they're not getting it from anywhere else. Now, the point is that those elements of Hamas that are against the Salafists, those elements of Hamas that think that Turkey is a good model for Palestine, those elements of Hamas that have been able to provide clinic services and hospitals and been able to provide good governance on some small level, those are elements that we don't need to be concerned with, or that we need to. Those are the elements that maybe need to be encouraged to divorce themselves from those elements that believe that violence against civilians can be a tool of national liberation.
Now, what if the individuals running these things turn out to be the same individuals?
Well, then we'll have a problem. But we haven't explored this, and what we haven't done is given Hamas a political stake in remaining outside of any terrorist activity.
I want to go back to this question I asked you before. What's your methodology? Mm-hmm. So, President Obama, does he authorize the CIA to go make discrete inquiries as to which individuals within the Hamas organization, which doctors, for example, which aid workers may be untainted by terrorism, might be interested in doing some kind of a deal, and to sort of keep a roster and to think of those as possible future people we could be associated with? Is that the method? Or do you have some?
Well, I think the first thing is to do an audit, because we have a lot of allies, very friendly countries
so
of the United States.
So we identify the individuals who are most dangerous.
That have already been doing a lot of this.
So we identify the individuals who are most dangerous and the individuals who are least dangerous.
Well, we identify, what we need to identify are those individuals who are engaged in planning and ordering attacks on civilians.
Okay.
Those are the people that we're not going to be able to deal with.
So we have, and this is done through the CIA or some other kind of intelligence agency?
I think that's up to the just before the president is going to, like, figure out his national security plan, going into presenting a kind of highly detailed plan of action for him only means that you're going to have that the suggestions you make are going to be ignored, or half of them are going to have to be ignored because the circumstances are going to change on a daily basis.
I'm just curious how you think this is. I mean,
unless I'm in for an
awestruck surprise, I don't know if you're up for a job in the Obama administration. But I'm not going to be worried. I'm going to be impressed. But working on the assumption that you're not, and we can talk about this. So how it would work. So the CIA or some other intelligence agency is working with other intelligence agencies in Europe and the Arab world to say, here are the individuals who have been engaged in attacks on civilians, and this is our blacklist. And then here are these other people who are in some way or another associated with Hamas, but we think they don't have blood on their hands, and these are people that maybe we should make some kind of discreet overture to see, and maybe talk to them in some way, one-on-one, to see how radical and extremist they are. Is that the way you envision this working?
That would be one way, and I'd be open to ideas on other ways as well.
Okay, so we basically have a big Rolodex of bad guys and less bad guys.
The dichotomy, the Manichaean dichotomy of people into black hats and white hats.
No, I'm not being Manichaean. I'm saying they're bad and less bad.
bad and less bad. Okay.
That's not Manu's system, I think.
We'll have to have a lay of the land. We'll have to know who's who, and we'll have to know.
Okay,
who's
so okay, that's step one. Okay, now step two.
And step one, I'll tell you what step one actually has. Step one is going to have to be that we're going to have to do something to show everybody, the Arab world, the Muslim world, that the United States cares and it empathizes with the casualties that have resulted from this conflict. Now, it's okay. We can blame whoever. We can still say it's Hamas's fault, and Hamas shouldn't have fired the rockets, and Israel had no choice but to kill this many people in its operation.
Okay, so
nevertheless,
we have to make some kind of big gesture of reconstruction and sympathy.
Yeah, and we have to back that up with finding a way of providing medical assistance. There are about 3,600 people so far who are wounded. A lot of them are going to die in the coming weeks because there's not going to be any medical assistance for them. People who've had arms blown off, et cetera, have been sent away from the hospitals because they're not wounded enough to be treated at the hospitals. And so,
this goes back to my question to you before, but can we come up with some kind of delivery system that isn't contaminated?
And here's one way of doing that. Here's a practical example of one way we might be able to do that. What if field hospitals were set up on the Egyptian side of the border, right outside of Gaza, mm-hmm. that were run by the United States or the Norwegians or the Swiss or the Turks or any of our European allies? And the ICRC was responsible for shuttling civilians, non-combatants, especially women and children, from inside Gaza, right outside of Gaza, right outside the border. And you have American doctors and Norwegian doctors and Swiss doctors and Turkish doctors healing and saving the lives of these Palestinian civilians.
That's a really good idea.
And then sending them back into Gaza.
That's a really good idea. Yeah, I hope the Obama administration does give you a job.
They don't need the hassle.
So that's sort of the gesture, and that's a way of creating non-contaminated institutions.
Yes, it begins the process. You can use an emergency relief effort as a means of establishing a longer term.
So you said this is something that's early, along with this the Rolodex construction. Right. Now on the political side, so our step two is okay. Now we have names of people who might, in some ways, be reachable. What now happens? Do we does somebody from AID or state make an overture to these individuals one by one, and how do we prevent them from being murdered if we do?
I don't know. They won't be murdered for talking to us. They'll decide to talk to us or not to talk to us. And I don't know who the best people are. I mean, the new Secretary of State, I'm sure will have strong opinions about that. Whether it should be somebody from state, should it be somebody from should it be somebody from outside of government? Should it be somebody from the agency? I don't know.
Yeah, so
I mean, that I'm not so concerned with who does it. I'm concerned that they have the authority of the president to do it.
Okay, so as you see it, step two is that after identifying people who might be reachable and detachable from terrorism, that you have some kind of political process where these individuals are contacted, spoken to, and their bona fides, their intentions are sort of assessed.
Yes, and I think we need to also, you know, and we need to make it clear publicly that there are things that, you know, we have red lines. There are things we refuse, there are people we refuse to deal with because they're engaged in this type of activity. And if you're not engaged in that kind of activity, then we may not have the same level of issue with you.
We've got a general rule and then a particular approach.
And we place it within the context that we're doing this because we know there has to be a free and independent Palestinian state in a very short order. If we don't frame it in that, if this becomes simply another way of managing the occupation on behalf of Israel, then ultimately we're going to become targets, or whoever we use are going to be the European Union, anybody else are going to become targets. So it has to be framed within the context of actually providing the Palestinians with freedom and providing the Israelis with security. And it's got to be seen as tandem, that these things are taking place in tandem. They're not conditional. I mean, in other words, Israel's security isn't conditional. We're not going to negotiate over Israel's security. We're not going to say one rocket fired into Israel is enough as opposed to 20 rockets. Israel, we have an unconditional support for Israel's security. But we also have to have an unconditional support for Palestinian freedom. And if we make it clear that that's our policy at the beginning, and then if we engage on the ground at the beginning in some of these ways that I'm talking about, I think that we'll find a lot of opportunities presenting themselves that we can't imagine right now that might make this process a lot easier and might make our negotiations elsewhere in the region with Iran and with other countries actually might increase our leverage in our ability to negotiate with them.
We're coming to the end of our time. I wonder if I could fire one last, maybe more philosophical question at you. Is your thinking about all of this based on the idea, look, we cannot expect the Palestinian political process to generate its own leadership spontaneously. It's really going to have to be cultivated from the outside, and that we are going to have to build the framework within which a new Palestinian leadership grows up.
I'd like to be surprised. I'd like to say that the Palestinians can, under occupation, develop an independent leadership that is able to not only make decisions, but implement its decisions across the board on all Palestinians. I'd like to be surprised and see that
happen. But you don't, in fact, believe that.
But I don't think that under the conditions of the occupation, it's going to be able to happen. Each time they've tried, it's actually broken apart over a matter of years. And I blame the Israelis much more than I blame the Palestinians for some parts of that, and I blame the Palestinians much more than I blame the Israelis for some parts of that.
But your conclusion, regardless, is that
we're going to have to play a top-heavy role in this. If we say to the Israelis and the Palestinians, well, when the two of you decide upon what the solution is, and the two of you have convinced each other of your positive intentions, then we'll be happy to come in and facilitate and implement. Okay. That's never going to happen.
All right. Now I'm left with one last, and this will be my last philosophical question. If that's true, if you're right, is it worth it? Is this dispute important enough to the United States to be worthy not just of the money, but actually something that is scarce of the money, the kind of energy and attention of the high levels of the U.S. government that a plan like yours would require?
I think that it is worth it because, besides the human benefit, of course, is because this conflict has become iconic. We can argue whether it should be iconic or whether, you know, or why it's iconic, but the truth of the matter is, whether you're Jewish, Christian, or Muslim, you care more about what's happening in Israel and in Palestine than you do about what's happening anywhere else in the world. And you can see that in the news coverage everywhere in the world, including in our country, and you can see that in the diplomatic activity of countries all over the world. More money flows into the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and Israel than anywhere else in the world if you per capita. And so if we can solve this, and if we're seen to be the reason that this is solved, this is going to have knock-on benefits everywhere else that we work, not just in the Middle East, but everywhere in the world. It's a transformative event.
This is extremely stimulating and interesting. I really thank you for the time. I find it very thought-provoking. I hope the viewers of Blogging Heads do too. I'm sure you're going to be a regular superstar here. Thank you. Nice to talk to you.
Take care. Bye-bye.